relationships, the people at the lowest or the grassroots, not the lowest in terms of best or worst, but lowest in terms of the grassroots relationships. And I have a tape here with me this evening that I think you're going to be wanting to hear. I want some of you who are going to Scotland this summer to get ready to think about doing the same kind of thing that my daughter Beth has done with a very important incident in Scottish Reformation history. And maybe you can't come up with the same accent that she has, but you can come up with the kind of story that she... What's making the thumping? Is there some system? Are we going to have an accompaniment tonight? but anyhow, I want you to be thinking about that and then to be looking forward to this evening. But let's get started before, as I say, it's going to be a very full evening. 48b, in our God city we have seen what we before were told, that God who is the Lord of hosts will ever it uphold. That God who is the Lord of hosts will ever it uphold. Within thy courts, O God, we thought upon thy gracious ways. O God, according to thy name, through all the earth thy praise. O God, according to thy name, through all the earth thy praise. Thy hand is full of righteousness, let Zion's joy be great. Eternity, yes, even on through death itself, our constant guide is He. Yes, even on through death itself, our constant guide is He. When you learn to sing these in Hebrew, you'll notice that there's not a period at the end of every stanza. It does sometimes go straight on into the next part of the sentence. To sons her story tell, because this God will be our God to all eternity. I'm very excited in talking with Alistair McEwen. I said, how do you teach Hebrew? He said, well, one of the things we do is teach the students to sing in Hebrew. Sing the Psalms in Hebrew. And the thought of the stanzas come through that way. Well, my old prof, who first began teaching me Hebrew, had told me that 100 years or so ago back in New Concord, Ohio, when I began learning Hebrew. And yet I'd never known of any Hebrew professor doing that until Alistair was telling me that that's what they do at Geelong, at the Reformed College over there in Geelong, where he's teaching Hebrew. the words that I'd like us to pay some attention to, just let me turn to them, is just two verses. John, the 8th chapter, verses 31 and 32. Then said Jesus to those Jews which believed on him. Now that'd apply to you and me, wouldn't it? Then said Jesus to us Jews, well, we can call ourselves Jews, those of us who believe on him. Then said Jesus to those who believe on him, if ye continue in my word, then are ye my disciples indeed, and ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. Those of you who believe, if you continue in my word, there's a bonus, there's a blessing, there's another blessing, then you're going to know the truth, and the truth will make you free. And we're moving this evening from the First Reformation into what's very often called the Second Reformation in Scotland. From the days of John Knox and the others that we've been talking about there, into the times of persecution. This involved James the Sixth and Charles the First and Charles the Second and the times of persecution. And there were political overtones to the Second Reformation. Jesus said, you believe in me, then if you continue on my word, it's going to affect every part of your life, including your political life. And so we're going to find some political encounters beginning to take place here with James the Sixth. We've already seen a little bit of it with John Knox and Mary Queen of Scots. But now we're going to see some more of that with James the Sixth and Charles the First and Charles the Second. And this is going to deeply influence the lives of the families, the men, the women, the children, the families of Scotland. And that's why I wanted you, I'm just hoping that we can press through hard this evening and then also hear some of this tape this evening. We have some exciting reports to hear from, and it's going to be a good time. The quiz before you right now, several people that Christ used in the early years in building his church in Scotland. Who was it that arrived at St. Regulus? At St. Andrew's, it was St. Regulus. And he had some of the relics, supposedly, of Andrew. And so that's one reason why it's called St. Andrew's yet today. Those of you who are over there are going to be seeing St. Andrew's. And who was the one that came from near Glasgow and then ministered in Ireland? Who? Patrick. St. Regulus arrived in St. Andrews on the Mediterranean Sea. St. Patrick was reared near Glasgow, but he ministered in Ireland, and St. Columba, who built a school of discipleship on the island of what?
Iona.
Please, if anybody tells you about Iona over there, please just be experts in it and know ahead of time that Iona is one of the landing ports for the entry of the gospel into Scotland. Don't be shocked. Where in the world is Iona? Please don't come from over here and say something like that over there. Just know that Iona is a sort of sacred ground to many people in Scotland. And it was a point of entry like the city of Ephesus in that part of the world in the days of the Apostle Paul. In the early years, the conversion process in Scotland was by clans. Was by clans as compared with individual conversions. The Romanizing of the church in Scotland was begun by Queen
Margaret.
Right, by Queen Margaret, who died in 1093 and established by her son David. Now that's way back, 1093 even. How did Parliament act to inform the nations that Reformation had come to Scotland in 1525? What was it she did, the Parliament? She banned Luther and his writings. It was just a proclamation that the Parliament made, but as we're looking through all the records of the nation of Scotland, that's a signal. That's a signal. It's here. Now, there were a lot of things going on long before that, but the signal that it was here could be seen as being 1525, and I'm not much for setting a date down saying that's when the Reformation began. Be careful of anybody that does that. But that was one of the first outward political, official, legal, visible statements that it really is here. John Knox was born around when? When?
1505.
Right. You'll get a good description of the debate on the subject of what his birthday was in Geddes in his The Thundering Scot, his biography. Knox became George Wishart's sword bearer in 1546. He's captured by the French in 1547. Keep an eye on these dates. Things were happening very rapidly to him. He was made a galley slave. After his release, Knox went to England, where he became chaplain to the king. Knox eventually returned to Scotland in 1559. That is a good summary right there in that one question of the life of John Knox. If in the final exam you had a question that said, just sort of review the life of John Knox in terms of five or six key dates, this would be the kind of thing that you might want to do. Which policy for worship was adopted in Scotland around this time? Which of these two? Second one. It was the second one. And incidentally, that's a policy for worship for the Reformed Presbyterian Church today. Very few other churches have followed that Reformation policy into today. Very, very few. I think they could save themselves a lot of trouble if they would follow that. But they've not done it. It was established a scriptural base rather than just some other base that is not very clear. Mary, Queen of Scots, landed in 1561. Remember that date. And demanded that she be allowed to celebrate the Mass. Check all that apply to Mary, Queen of Scots in her times. Did anyone check number one?
Yes.
You're exactly right if you did that. Did anyone check number two? I don't like to see people hold up their hands when they're wrong. Don't check number two. Don't check number three. Don't check number four. Did anyone check number five? Yeah. Did anyone check number six? Yeah. That tells you right there. All right. How many chapters in D. Hay Fleming's book, The Scottish Reformation, have you read? How many have read one chapter? How many have read two chapters? You've read it all. How many have read three? Good. How many have read four? I mean, you are getting behind. How about five? All right. Now, that's not a very big book. And we've not required much reading. So I'm going to go ahead and test you on some of this. Name four martyrs that are mentioned in chapter 2 of Fleming's book. Four martyrs. If you have named James Resby or Paul Craw or Patrick Hamilton or Henry Forrest or David Straton or Norman Gourlay or Duncan Simpson or Robert Forrester or Thomas Ferrey, or Russell, or Kennedy, or Robert Lamb, or William Anderson, or James Hunter, or William Shirk. If you've named any of those, then give yourself full credit there. If you've named any four of those, give yourself full credit. If you've named two, then just give half credit, and you know how to do the arithmetic. It's higher math, but you can do it from there on. Chapter 3 begins by describing how the controversy over images came to a head on what day? What day was that? Remember, they brought that thing in because the old one had been thrown into the loch, the big one, the one that went with the church that it was in, the big church in Edinburgh. The big church in Edinburgh. St. Giles. And that one had been thrown into the loch. And the loch or into the water anyhow. And so they brought this little makeshift thing in, and before it was over, it was The people reacted to it. Chapter 3 of D.A. Fleming. See, I'm checking up on whether or not you've read the book. And I really do want you to read that. It'll be profitable reading. And I've not required much reading in here, but I don't want you to get into the position of just taking what the lecture is. I want you to do your own reading. And there will be another book that you'll be having to read after you get over there, and that's J.G. Voss's book on the history of the Covenanters.
Pastor Healy is also requiring Fleming, too.
Yes.
So it's a double requirement.
That's right. And you'll have a head start on others there when you have Fleming read ahead of time. I'm sure that that his exams are going to involve a knowledge of Fleming. I sent him over the same thing that we gave to you. I sent over to him, and he liked it so much. I guess he hadn't seen the abridged edition. The big copy of Fleming's book is about that thick. It's a good-sized book. And this is the abridged copy, and I guess he hadn't seen it before he sent it over, and he liked it so much that now he's requiring the two books of all that are in that course. And that will be that'll be a course that is of graduate school level. And yet you don't need to be afraid of it, especially not if you've already read one of those two books. And by God's grace, I believe you'll have the second one in your hands before we finish this class here.
Which book by Voss?
Not any of the ones on biblical theology or anything, history, the history of the Covenanters. He only has one on that.
Okay, now that's G. Voss?
Yes.
History of the Covenanters, thank you.
Yeah. All right, I want to now pass your papers in, please, and then Trevor, can you help pick those papers up this evening just right away? And we'll go right straight into this lecture. Do you have the handouts? Are the handouts with them, each person yet? They've already out. Good, okay. These handouts, I think, will save you a lot of time and will help you very, very much in your timeline. Keep your timelines up to date with the content of each evening's lecture, and you'll be way ahead in your thinking. If you have a chronological framework into which to fit these things, it will help so very much. I had been away from timelines for a long time, and then I saw Russ Pulliam beginning to work with timelines here, and it reminded me of how important they are. To know the sequence of events through which Christ led his church in the building of that church is very important. The beautiful, talented Mary, Queen of Scots, born when? When? Born when? 1542. I just got done telling you about this timeline here. They've held up. Born in 1542. Now, sort of focus on that for a minute. That's 1542. She married. Who was her first husband?
The Dauphin.
The Dauphin. That's the son of the king. In France. He is the king. So she was a queen in France. In 1550, all right, girls, I know how you can help remember these things. She was born when? How old was she when she was married the first time? 15. Don't you have your timeline in front of you? Does anybody not have one of these? Anybody not have one? Okay, there's need for two more back here. How old was she when she was married the first time? 16. Can you remember that? How many of you are 16 or older? She was married by that time. She was 16 years old when she was married the first time. Beg pardon? 15, okay. 15 coming on 16. Okay. And queen at that point. She was recognized as being the queen of France. And what happened to her husband? He died. He was a sickly man. She was very sickly when she was over there too. But he died, and she came back to Scotland, and became recognized as the Queen of Scotland, Queen of two nations, Queen of France and Queen of Scotland. And she abdicated in disgrace the throne of Scotland on the 24th of July in 1567. How old would she have been? Born in 1542, abdicated in 1567. How old would she have been when she abdicated? 25. She was beheaded in 1587. How old would she have been then? 45 years old. The events leading up to her death are events that the Scots do not like to talk about. But it's pretty important that you would know, because this has to do with Christ's building of his church. She married when she returned to Scotland. This is her second husband, Lord Darnley. 8 months later, Rizzio was murdered. Those of you who go to Holyrood Palace, they will probably show you that. It's a little bit like the film of Samson and Delilah, in which they play up, and I don't like the film, because they play up the evil, the sin that was in that relationship. And Rizzio was an Italian who was a musician, and he won his way into Mary's heart and to her most intimate relationships. Until finally the Scottish nobles couldn't stand it any longer. And they killed him there in Holyrood Palace. And we've talked in pretty general terms about the immorality in the Roman Catholic Church. That which took place in the Vatican, that which took place across Europe, and that which took place in Scotland. Now we're seeing it up close. In terms of Mary herself, she married Darnley, her second husband, just after returning to Scotland. 8 months later, this man Rizzio was murdered. 6 months later, James VI was born. That was Mary's only son, the only child she had. He was born 6 months later. 8 months later, her husband, Lord Darnley, was married. A man by the name of Bothwell, Lord Bothwell, was deeply involved in Lord Darnley's murder. He was in a house, a very cheap kind of house, in Edinburgh, not far from where the university is today. And it was blown up with gunpowder. And he was killed. And everyone knew that Bothwell had been involved in killing Lord Darnley. And just 3 months and 5 days after Darnley was killed, Mary married Bothwell. And just 10 days after Bothwell was divorced, now Mary had been deeply involved in helping the new bride and groom to get married, Bothwell. And then just a few months after their marriage, Bothwell became involved with Mary, Queen of Scots. And then married him very promptly, just 3 months after her husband was killed. And 1 month later, she separated from him forever. And when she did come back, at one point, and I've forgotten now all the details of it, but she did come back in sight of the troops there in Edinburgh. But the Mary Queen of Scots, who had so much loyalty to her as the Queen of Scots, the troops said, "Burn the harlot! Burn the harlot!" And that was behind the fact that she abdicated and then escaped across the border into England and was imprisoned by Elizabeth, who was the Queen of London. And Mary she was trying to become also Queen of England. She never stopped scheming. And she entered into all kinds negotiations with through the Catholic Church, with princes and others in both Spain and France, in trying to win the throne of England, until finally it became so much of an embarrassment to Elizabeth that she had her beheaded. And she lived longer in England there. She was just 45 years old when she was beheaded. But it was a sort of a meteor, her career. And she was so beautiful and so talented, so capable in so many ways, and yet she threw it all away. And she was reared in the court over there in France, and it was a very, very immoral court. And she was just living out in front of the whole world in Scotland the kind of life that was typical of the church in France. John Knox died on the 24th of November in 1572. Anyone know how old he was? How much?
67.
I think he was more than that. Do we have a date for him, for his birth? I don't know the answer to that question. I should never ask a question I don't know the answer to, but I don't know it yet.
57 would be all right.
57 would be all right, all right.
67.
67, all right. Knox is usually painted as being the criminal and the culprit and the evil man who is making the poor, beautiful queen cry. But when you know something of the history behind it, as I pray that you would now, you'll see how Jesus Christ was building his church. James Melville described John Knox's preaching. Now, don't mix him up with Andrew Melville. They're cousins, But James Melville described Knox's preaching during the last months of his life. Quote, in the opening of his text, those of you who are interested in preaching, pay attention. In the opening of his text, he was moderate the space of half an hour. But when he entered into the application, he made me so grow and tremble I could not hold a pen to write. Powerful, powerful preaching from Knox. People forget that today in his biography, but it had a marked impact in the whole nation of Scotland. He would come in and repose himself in our college yard and call us scholars to himself and bless us and exhort us to know God and his work in our country and stand by the good cause. Another time, Melville tells about how in his last days they lifted him up to the pulpit where he behooved to lean at first entry. He'd have to lean on the pulpit. But ere he had done with his sermon, he was so active and vigorous that he was like to ding the pulpit to blats and fly out of it. And Regent Morton said of Knox at his grave outside St. Giles in Edinburgh, here lieth a man who in his life never feared the face of man. But even before Knox's death, the church at the Leith Convention in 1572 began to find herself being crowded into a modified episcopacy. No one wanted bishops or episcopacy, but finances became an important factor. And incidentally, watch for the finances in churches today. You'll find them leading churches and even whole denominations. It is a very, very dangerous waters. Finances there were a major factor. The nobles and the landlords who had recently regained their lands, that is from the church, people had given away their lands to the church because this would buy them less time in purgatory or even buy them straight passage into heaven. So they would give great tracts of land, and half of Scotland, it was said at one time, belonged to the church. Now, with the fall of the Roman Catholic Church and with the removal of the Catholic Church, then these lands were given back to the original owners. And the nobles and the landlords who had recently regained their lands, along with the rents and the income from those lands, became greedy. They failed to give to the new ministers or pastors or churches any or enough of the income from their properties. Apparently, and I've not checked this through in Knox's writings, but I'd like to throw that out as a suggestion for some of you really interested in the development of the church. I'd like to challenge you to do some research on this. Apparently, no one was really teaching the tithe of the individual. And people were not giving. They depended upon the income from these lands and other such things to support the church. Knox may have acquiesced in the fact that the nobles were holding these monies for themselves instead of giving them to the churches to a plan that was once summarized this way. There be three kinds of bishops in Scotland. And this was a common phrase in Scotland at that time. My Lord Bishop, my Lord's Bishop, and the Lord's Bishop. Three kinds of bishops in Scotland. My Lord Bishop was what we had in the Roman Catholic Church. My Lord's, apostrophe as possessive, Bishop, is what we have now. And these are people who are speaking and explaining what they mean back in these days we're talking about. My Lord's possessive, comma, S, bishop, is what we have now when my Lord, that is the landlord, the noble, who is named or called a bishop, gets the fat of the benefits, the income from the land, and the person who is really doing the work in the church is just bishop in title only. the ecclesiastical title holder. Then the third one, the Lord's bishop, is the true minister of the gospel who needs the income from the land and should have been getting it, but wasn't. Now going back to say a little more about that second one, my Lord's apostrophe S possessive bishop. The people call them, they were titular bishops, the people call them Tulchan bishops. T-U-L-C-H-A, do we have that spelled? T-U-L-C-H-A-N, Tulchan bishops. That is, when a cow wouldn't give her milk, then they stuff a calf's skin with straw and set it down right in front of the cow or close to the cow so that she'll begin to let her milk down. The stuffed skin was called a tulchan. And so the bishop that got the, that is the lord, the noble, that got the income, and then the person that did the church, the work in the church, were compared, and the people said that's just a tulchan bishop. Andrew Melville was the man that Christ brought along to pick up where Knox left off in his building of his church. Andrew Melville was born in 1545, and incidentally, I don't think we have anyone with a report on Andrew Melville, and I'd like to suggest that that would be a worthy report. Some of you students who are involved in Greek, he was identified as being a real Grecian scholar. Born in 1545, educated at St. Andrew's, reported to be the best philosopher, the best poet, and the best Grecian scholar in all of Scotland. Thomas McCree, in his biography, remember we had Thomas McCree, somebody was quoting from him, his biography of John Knox, and he's written a history of Scotland. He's an older writer, but he is an excellent writer. And anytime you find a history book or a biography on of these men, of Melville or Knox or history of Scotland that doesn't make any acknowledgement of McCree, just chalk it down that the man is not very knowledgeable. He's either ignoring him on purpose or else there's just a real blind spot in his study in history and research. Because McCree is really good. And he was close enough to the times that he had access to information that other people just don't have. McCree tells it in biography that Andrew Melville was a godly, strong, gifted man of conviction. Melville was in the universities of Paris and then of Poitiers at the very time of the persecution. Communicating? What kind of persecution was it that France suffered through? What were those?
The massacres.
No country faced as many massacres. The Guise family and the political situation, other things like that. The St. Bartholomew's Day massacre especially. But Alexander Hamilton was over there in France when these things were taking place. The Huguenots were being persecuted. Because of that persecution, Alexander Hamilton, Andrew Melville, left France to continue his education in Geneva, Switzerland. Calvin had died in 1564. But Theodore Beza was a man who had been discipled by Calvin, and he taught Andrew Melville. Beza once said to one of the kings of Europe, and I'm going to ask that you would remember this, because this is Beza now from Geneva, Switzerland, and he's speaking to one of the kings of Europe. And I think you're going to find that his student, Andrew Melville, is going to be saying something like this to one of the kings of Scotland a little bit later on. But you see if you can make that connection. Beza once said to one of the kings of Europe, "Sire, it belongs in truth to the Church of God to endure blows and not to inflict them, but it will also please your majesty to remember that the church is an anvil that has worn out many hammers. You see how they talked in those days, very respectfully. He says, King, you're the hammer, and God made you to be the hammer, and the church needs to be very respectful to you. But let me remind you of something, that church is the anvil that has worn out many hammers. And after finishing his own coursework at Geneva, Andrew Melville remained at Geneva to teach, and he maintained close relationships with many of the leaders of the Reformation in France and Switzerland. They liked him as a student. They promoted him to become a professor in the same school through which he had grown. He returned to Scotland in 1574, and Beza said that the greatest token of affection that the Church of Geneva could show to Scotland was that they allowed themselves to be deprived of Andrew Melville, and I'm quoting now, that thereby the Church of Scotland might be enriched. Beza said, we really appreciate this man, Andrew Melville, over here. And one of the greatest proofs of our love for the church clear up there in Scotland is the fact that go. Again, I want to point out to you how behind the scenes and between the lines of Reformation history, Jesus is doing Jesus' work in Jesus' way. The way Paul worked with Timothy in 2 Timothy 2:2. I wonder if I had one of those markers for a minute. Yeah, here's one.
And
a blank one so we won't have to wipe it off with a wet cloth, which we don't have right now. All right. 2 Timothy 2:2. Paul. The things that thou hast heard of me, Timothy, among many others, your mother, grandmother, and your mother, and many others, the things that you've heard of me, among many others, the same commit thou to faithful men, Mr. Faithful Man, who will be able to communicate them to Mr. Others also. Now we have a man, this is Paul here, a man by the name of Martin Bietzer, who worked with a man named John Calvin. I told you before that Calvin, every time he got loose from Geneva, he would go to Strasbourg, where Martin Bietzer was, and he considered Martin Bietzer to be his mentor, who worked with a man named Beza. Who worked with a man named Andrew, what's his name?
Melville.
Let's put your name in here, And who is the person that God's using you with? This is a Reformation principle. This is a principle of Scripture that the Reformers were carrying out. Now, you won't find that written out in Scripture in history. Unless a historian knows this in his own life, he won't see it. But when you do know this in your own life, then look for it, and you'll find it in history. And who else was it that John Calvin worked with John Knox. John Knox worked with someone else. And you'll find these going all through history. Christ used Melville first as principal of Glasgow University. See, Glasgow University was formed at about this time. then as principal of St. Mary's College in St. Andrews. Those of you who go to Scotland this summer will see St. Mary's College. It's still one of the colleges of St. Andrews. Through those positions, Christ opened the door for Andrew Melville to live his life into the lives of hundreds of other students who later became pastor teachers. He was a professor, but he was a bold man of great conviction. When the regent threatened to have Melville hung or banished for teaching his students his convictions, living them into their lives, Melville said to him, and I'm quoting, "Tush! Threaten your courtiers in that way. But it is all the same to me whether I rot in the air or in the ground. The earth is the Lord's. My fatherland is wherever well-doing is. It will not lie in your power to hang or to exile God's word." Strong, brave words. Another time, when he was brought before a commission of the king for subscribing to the Articles of the Reformation, one of the nobles there said, "Who dares to subscribe to these horrible articles?" Melville stepped forward, took up the pen, and said, "We dare and will subscribe and render our lives in this cause." But unusual for a university professor. We usually do not think of professors as being people of conviction. Most Christian professors begin by saying, "Well, now there are some who teach this, and 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 some who teach this," and they give all sides of evolution, for example. And then, unless you're very careful, you have to go back and say, "But where, what do you teach? What do you really believe?" And usually they're so good at it after years of experience that you walk away even after asking questions, still don't know. That's not true of all of them, but that's true of entirely too many of them. And university professors especially. This was an unusual university professor. He let his students know where his convictions are, not just what everyone else is teaching, but what his convictions actually are. In 1581, Melville succeeded in having the church accept the second book of discipline, which Melville himself had written. Well, he hadn't done it all by himself. He had done it with a lot of help from a lot of other men. Who succeeded and passed? Accepted? John Knox. Say it out loud. John Knox. Yes. Now here's a spiritual son of his, grandson, coming along, and it was the first General Assembly that approved that first book of discipline. The second book of discipline, and all I can do here is say a little bit about it and challenge you to go on and do some more study in it. The second book of discipline, which was largely written by Melville as a sort of a spiritual grandson of Knox, spelled out in more detail the offices of the teaching and ruling elders and deacons. Elders, listening? I don't know where this fits into the picture. I'm not interested in changing what our policy is. I think there's good warrant for it in Scripture. But elders, according to the second book of discipline, were elected or re-elected every year. As the pastors, and the quote from the book of discipline, "As the pastors should be diligent in teaching and sowing the word, so the elders should be careful in seeking the fruits of the same among the people." The pastors did the teaching. The ruling elders did what we very often call pastoral work today. Oh, maybe what we're doing is better. But at least this was a means that Jesus Christ used at the early stages in the building of churches. And I believe I've seen where that takes place, where there are new churches. I don't see that so much in churches that have been there for 30, 40, 50 years, or 150 years. But where there are new churches, I do find that the teaching elders do a lot of the teaching, and the ruling elders do a lot of the of what's usually called pastor work. In the second book of discipline, church-state relationships are being spelled out in more detail, more carefully. Quote, the civil power should command the spiritual power to exercise and do their office according to the word of God. The civil power should command the spiritual powers to exercise, do their office. Can you imagine the civil government saying to the churches, now get busy. You do what you've been taught, you get busy with that. You get busy with that. The spiritual rulers should require the Christian magistrate to minister justice, punish vice, maintain the liberty and quietness of the kirk. There's something that the state is to do for the church, and there's something the church is to do for the state. And the struggle between episcopacy or hierarchicalism and Presbyterianism continued to develop throughout this period that we're talking about right now, just subsequent to John Knox, in the days of Andrew Melville. Archbishop Patrick Adamson of St. Andrews, now supported and promoted by King Henry VI, who is how old in 1584? 18 years old. It's interesting as you get these dates. Why now? How old is the kid now? Well, you a little bit of math will fix it for you. He's just 18 years old, but he's king. So what's an 18-year-old going to do? Well, he's becoming very much interested.
What king is this?
King Henry VI. King Henry VI. And he is backing the Archbishop of St. Andrews, a man named Patrick Adamson. He's taking an active part in the struggle. King Henry VI, and this is a way of remembering King Henry VI, and a little bit his own son, Charles I, after that. But King Henry VI liked to practice what he called kingcraft, his kingcraft. And he was quite a scholar. George Buchanan had educated him, and it was a tutoring job. He was homeschooled. And he was quite good in Greek, and he knew his Latin. And he considered himself to be a scholar. Some people call him a wise fool. But he had a lot of wisdom, a lot of knowledge anyhow. And how much wisdom, well, you could decide that as you go along. But King Henry is beginning to practice his kingcraft. And in 1592, Andrew Melville, got both the king and the parliament to approve of what has been called the Magna Carta of Scottish Presbyterianism. That is, a church government program. It's a system of church government which involved general assemblies and synods and presbyteries and sessions as we know them today yet. Now, this is going to be important a little bit of time because the people down south, who was just south of the border? What did they call them? What country was that?
English.
They didn't know nothing. They didn't know anything about this kind of government. But Melville gotten the General Assembly and the King even to support him at this time anyhow in that. The General Assembly and the Parliament and the King even reluctantly approved of it. The General Assembly's met once a year. The Synod's met twice a year. Presbyteries are a brand new development. And those of you who will be involved in presbytery meetings in the years ahead need to pay attention to the fact
that they did not begin with presbyteries. They just came in later as a necessary added addition. Synods were there, general assemblies were there, kirksessions were there, but there wasn't a presbytery in between them. And I'll talk more about that. You're going to have to read five major papers that I wrote on that subject. presbyteries were a development beginning in about 1580 to fill in between the synods and the kirksessions, which grew out of the exercise meetings of the church throughout Scotland. As King James VI grew older, he took more and more interest in the church-state relationships. He saw how King Henry VIII down south, his neighbor down south in England, had taken over the position of head of the church in place of the Pope. Now, that wasn't in his time. It was before his time. But he knew the history of how King Henry VIII had taken over the church and just become not only king of the civil government, but head of the church. And how the civil government had continued to direct and control the church. The civil government controlled and directed the church. It was called Erastianism. The church became a kind of a department of the state. Just as there is a Bank of England, so there was a Church of England. And if you want to get into an interesting discussion sometimes, I heard a very humorous presentation of this once. What is it that you're supposed to earn at a bank? What are you supposed to earn at a bank if it's a good bank? Some profit. Some profit. Don't become so spiritually minded you're no earthly good, or heavenly minded. You're supposed to earn some profit at a bank. And what is it that churches deal with? Profits. So watch for this kind of thing anyhow. You'll see the Church of Scotland over there and the Church of and the Bank of Scotland. The church was a kind of a department of the state, the way the king saw it. And King James liked this idea of the state being in control of the church. He spelled it out in detail in a book that he wrote. Basilicon Doron. Basilicon? What's that? What's that? What's the Greek word connected with that?
Kingdom.
Kingdom. King and kingdom. Doron. He published that book in 1598, and it's his effort, you see, now to sort of counterbalance this Magna Carta Presbyterianism, and so he's writing a book to set the record straight and make sure they didn't get too far out from under him. His control of the church affairs, James said, was no, I'm quoting from James, King James now, no small part of his office as king. It was an important part of what he called his kingcraft. That was not the way Andrew Melville saw it. Melville saw shades of Pope Hildebrand in James's attitude towards the church and was alarmed. And well, he should be. Melville saw clearly that Christ had planned for both church and state, that neither one depended on the other, that both depended on Christ. And once when King James had summoned a group of ministers to Stirling to talk with them about these things, in a private session, this was a private session, it wasn't open to the public, the media was banned, Melville, seeing an opportunity, stepped close to the king, and he said, and this is a very famous quote, "There be twa kings and twa kingdoms in Scotland." I can't go on with the Scottish brogue from there on. But do you know what he's saying? There be twa kings and twa kingdoms. Two kings and two kingdoms in Scotland. There is King James, the head of the Commonwealth. And there is Christ Jesus, the King of the Church, whose subject King James VI is, and of whose kingdom he is not a king, nor a lord, nor a head, but a member. Now those who sometimes say that he said they're a silly vassal, I think there was more respect in Melville than that for the office. But nevertheless, King James didn't like what he said, whether he called him a silly vassal or whether he said a common citizen.
Silly had a very different meaning in those times. It meant weak.
Yeah.
Weak,
yeah.
As opposed to what we think of the term.
And the word vassal would have carried a real meaning to the king, too. And it's true, he was a vassal of King Jesus, of King Christ. And the king, James VI, did not like that for a minute. And he had Melville eventually locked up for it, and then he had him banished. What James wanted was that, quote, and I'm quoting from King James at this point, "The bishops must rule the ministers, and the king rules both." He wouldn't take any chances. Bishops are going to have to rule the ministers, and the king rules both. And one of the phrases that he liked very, very much, no bishop, no king. If the people will not kowtow, respond, submit to a bishop in ecclesiastical affairs, then they will not submit to a king in civil and political affairs. Many people in Scotland feared James's plan, lest it take them back into the Church of Rome. And in 1605, they tried to hold an assembly in Aberdeen to discuss the whole subject. James condemned their assembly, and he sent Andrew Melville and James Melville, his nephew, and other leaders into exile. By 1610, James had a full-fledged Episcopalian or hierarchical form of church government operating in Scotland. So his kingcraft was effective, but it was a little too effective. He still wasn't satisfied. There was more kingcraft to practice. So in 1603, I preceded myself there, went to 1610 to say this is where it's leading, but in 1603, he inherited the throne of England. See, the queen died, and from then on, every part of his kingcraft was bent towards bringing the Scottish church and the Scottish civil government too into line with the English church and the English civil government. Here's a man who's king of both countries. Well, the more similarity he can bring them to, the more it's in fact that he is king of both countries. And since he is the head of the church in England, and there was no contesting that ever since the days of Henry VIII, the king had been known as being the head of the church in Ireland, then the simple thing would be for him to be recognized as the head of the church also in Scotland. And in order to bring these two nations that now suddenly he's king of both of, to bring them into line with each other, he's trying to force the Scottish people, who are much, there are much fewer people in Scotland than there were in England, he's trying to bring them together. And the worship services of the Church of England were very much more like the pre-Reformation Roman church than they were like what the Scottish people had been enjoying since before the days of Knox. This is the setting for the Second Reformation in Scotland. James, practicing his kingcraft, was determined to bring the Scottish people and the Scottish church into line with his newly acquired English church and nation. So, in 1618, James demanded that the Scottish church accept the five articles of Perth. The five articles of Perth. Kneeling at communion. Permission to have communion privately. Permission to baptize privately. Confirmation of bishops. The observations of Christmas, Easter, and other special days. Now, if you have noticed in the Reformed Presbyterian Church that there's not much attention paid to Christmas or Easter or other things like that, the days leading up to it, you're probably right. This is a Reformation Presbyterian Church. And the king tried to force these special days on the Scottish people back in his day. At this point, another great leader emerged. His name is Alexander Henderson. And again, I'd like to just tickle your fancy and your interest in this man a little bit. Alexander Henderson was born in 1582. Wish we had someone reporting on him. Had been around then. I'm not sure the exact time, but it was around then. He had been a prelatist, teaching philosophy in St. Andrews, and he had been pressed on the church, the congregation of Leuchars. L-E-U-C-H-E-R-S. Do we have that spelled? He'd been pressed on the congregation of Leuchars. Pressed on. He had been imposed. He was the man who was appointed to be the curate. The king appointed him. He was going to be their pastor. And the people knew that he didn't know the Lord, and they didn't want him. And so they simply got to the church the night before and nailed the doors and the windows all shut. And he couldn't get in. The party that was coming to ordain him and install him couldn't get in. And so they finally found a window up higher that wasn't as tight as the others, and they broke in. And he went in through the window. And they ordained him anyway. This is the way the king did things. You are going to be my king. My curate, there. He was forced on the congregation. A few years later, his people were all out listening to these outed ministers who were preaching out in the fields. And Robert Bruce was one of those preachers who was preaching out in the fields. So Henderson did what you might imagine a man would do if he was really interested. He disguised himself and he joined the crowd that was going out into the fields to listen to what they were listening to out there that they wouldn't come to him to hear. And it just so happened that the text that that Robert Bruce was preaching on that way, "Verily, verily, I say unto you, he that entereth not in by the door, but climbeth up some other way, the same as a thief and a robber." Had tremendous impact. Tremendous impact. He became a Christian. He went back. His life was changed. Tremendous change. He wrote the National Covenant, not by himself, but we'll see where it fits in here a little bit later on, 1638. He was the man that God used under those circumstances to write that National Covenant. Not alone. There was a very, very excellent attorney who worked with him. And he moderated three of the most crucial general assemblies that the Church of Scotland ever had. Now, there were many other ministers, but he was chosen as the moderator of three of them. He was one of the commissioners that the Church of Scotland sent down to Westminster from Scotland. And there were just 9 years of his life that were left, but they were very full years. Alexander Henderson is a very, very important man in Scottish history, and I hope I've pricked your curiosity to the point of your wanting to go on and read some more and study about that. The people were objecting to what King James was doing for two reasons. The king should leave these items that I listed, those five items up there, kneeling at communion and permission to have communion privately, and those five items. The king ought to leave those kinds of decisions to the General Assembly. That's what the people were saying. These changes that the king was imposing tended to bring the church back towards where it had come from in the Roman Catholic Church. They did not see Rome as being just another Christian church. They believed that it was not Christian at all, but actually anti-Christian. Now, you wouldn't find very many people saying that today, would you? And yet, these people were pretty close to the facts as far as what the church, that church really is. Are we closer to the facts today than they were? Well, I'm not sure. I'm not sure. But before you turn them off and say, well, they were just bigoted people, who had a prejudice against the Roman Catholic Church. You need to know what the church was, and you need to then know why it was that. They believed that it was not Christian at all. They believed that the Pope was anti-Christ. Not the vicar of Christ, but anti-Christ. And as such, he would be Satan's servant. And the power of the Church of Rome was the thing they were afraid of. They had some real reason to be afraid of it. In 1618, the 30 Years' War on the continent was just beginning. It was a desperate struggle between Romanism and Reformation Christians on the continent. And the Synod of Dort in Holland, that same year, 1618, spelled out the differences between the old Roman Church, the papacy, and the new Reformation Church. Really spell that out. If you want to get some good research about, now, what is the difference between the Reformation Church and the Roman Catholic Church, go look at the facts as these came out in that Synod of Dort. And in 1620, the Christians in Bohemia, whose queen was a daughter of King James VI himself. These families are related. But the Queen of Bohemia was a daughter of King James VI in 1620. And these Christians in Bohemia were terribly, terribly, terribly beaten and persecuted by the Habsburg family, who were supported and directed, really, by the Pope. No wonder so many of the Scots people feared the Church of Rome with all of her continuing persecutions and immoralities. Many of her friends had demonstrated for all Scotland to see. Mary, for example, had. What is the Roman Catholic Church? What is the influence long range? What influence do these things, does this church have on our families? In spite of all that King James and his kingcraft could do, perhaps because of that, the people of Scotland grew more and more afraid of the direction he was going and more in favor of the church being free to guide her own spiritual life, to worship God in spirit and in truth, to avoid Romey superstitions and images, to keep church responsibilities out of the power of the state, to give the people a responsibility to regulate the government of the church. In 1625, King James VI did what all kings do. He died. And King Charles I took over. And his father's attitudes and policies continued. Charles I continued his dad's policies, but he did not have his father's skills of kingcraft. He was cruder and less successful. He meddled, for example, with the finances and the taxation of the nation in such a way as to bring out Scottish nobles and landowners against him. King James had managed to keep them with him. King Charles didn't have the political and business skills to know how to do that. And so the nobles began to oppose the king. More and more people of all ranks, not only the common people, but also the nobility, began to dislike Charles. They stopped trusting him. Charles made a man by the name of Laud, who was Archbishop of Canterbury, to be his advisor in all church matters. Now that's down in Britain, down in England. And yet this man is guiding him and counseling him insofar as Scottish policy is concerned. And the way Charles and Laud went about the restructuring of the church in Scotland in order to bring it in line was worst of all, and finally brought matters to a head. You know, I thought about this a few years ago because the World Council of Churches had a tremendous program in which they were teaching all different denominations and churches what they called a restructuring program. which was really aimed at having one church throughout the world, but especially in the U.S. And I was working with a couple of very large disciples churches at that time, and became aware, and they did too, of the policies that were being driven down from the top as far as World Council was concerned, so that the congregations become more and more responsive to the governing bodies of the World Council of Churches. And the Reformed Presbyterian Church in Muncie, Indiana today is one result of that, because the people recognized that the restructuring that was going on was not really for the good of the church so much as it was to bring it under one church government. Charles was doing this kind of work. Charles and Laud tried to force Scottish worship into the mold of the 1636 English Book of Canons. They ordered the 1637 liturgy, prayer book, to be used in all parish churches throughout Scotland. The Scottish people reacted to that idea. It's one thing to be working with the bishops and archbishops and have their... It's another thing to contact the people at that point where they are worshiping God. And this was what was taking place. The Scottish people reacted to the idea. And I'm quoting from a phrase that was very common then, "Our poor country made over into an English province." That was the attitude. Our poor country of Scotland made over into an English province. Two Scottish bishops had helped Charles and Laud to review the English book and revise it to fit the Scots, but the Scottish church had not really been consulted in that work. And so the new liturgy was imposed on the Scottish church by Charles, acting on his idea of the divine being the divine right of a king. I have that right. God gave me that right. I am the head of the church. God gave that responsibility and right to me, and I will impose my liturgy on them. The Scots were not opposed to a liturgy because John Knox had written a liturgy. But somehow or other, the liturgy he wrote was different. It's very interesting to compare those two books of liturgy, those two liturgies. And we're getting a call today from some Reformation sources to come back with a liturgy. And I have to think that one through pretty carefully, because I'm not confident that that's what God had wanted in New Testament times on anyway. And I don't think it was true in the Old Testament either, in the worship. But anyhow, Laud and Charles were imposing this liturgy that they had written on the Scottish church. And on the 23rd of July, 1637, the new liturgy was to be read for the first time in St. Giles Cathedral in Edinburgh. You have to realize that St. Giles Cathedral is sort of the capital. What they do there, they do all over the nation. And so this is to be done for the first time, to be read for the first time, July the 23rd, 1637. But as the minister stands up and begins to read it, the church is crowded on that particular day, and people, the landholders and the nobles and all the others have pews to sit on, but the servants have to crowd into the aisles, and they bring with them their little seats, their little milk stools, three-legged stools called creepies. And there was a lady there by the name of Jenny Geddes. And as the minister began reading the new liturgy that day for the first time in Scotland, she stood up and she said, "Villain, ye will nae say lug my mass." And she threw her stool at him. And "Villain, you'll not say a liturgy at my funeral. My lug may be at my ear." I'm not sure what that phrase means, and I've seen it interpreted in a different way. "You may say mass at my lug, at my ear, at my funeral." I don't know which it is. A riot followed, and early in 1638, the leaders called the congregation to come to Edinburgh. the leaders of the church called the congregation to come to Edinburgh. Who was it who had taught them to do that in a previous generation? Calling the congregation to Edinburgh. A man by the name of John Knox. The Christians were called to come to Edinburgh. And up to this point, this was an unusual procedure. You can't imagine what an earth-shaking procedure this is. To have 100, 1,000, 2,000 people or more come to Edinburgh and say to the government and say to the church, "What are you doing? What are you doing?" Transportation, communication wasn't then as it is today. And so when they realized that here were thousands of people coming to look over their shoulders at what they were doing, it sort of shook up the troops. I received my U.S. News and World Report today. And the main article in this U.S. News and World Report is on a man by the name of James Dobson. And there are lots of things that I can find fault with for James Dobson. But several months ago, James Dobson had said to the Republican leaders in the Congress, both senators and representatives, "You're not producing the kind of legislation and leadership that we elected you to produce. And unless you change, we're going to abandon you and form a new policy, a new party." That has really shaken up the troops. This article in the U.S. News and World Report, and I just skimmed it before it came down, but pointed out that he has 10 million people a day listening to him. That's quite a little chunk of the American population. And so the Republican Party, both senators and representatives, are listening. And they're asking kinds of questions. And it's a pretty grassroots support that he has there. I don't know what the results of that's going to be, but I think maybe it's like calling the congregation to Edinburgh, as John Knox did it back in his day. And now, as these men are learning to do it in their day. And they wrote and signed the National Covenant. Who was it wrote that National Covenant? Remember, I gave you just a little bit of a thumbnail sketch. Henderson. Alexander Henderson. The National Covenant of 1838 was written not only by Alexander Henderson, but by a very excellent attorney, Johnston. Of Warriston. Yes. Johnston of Warriston. S-T-O-N. And both these were godly leaders. That covenant was made up of three parts. The negative confession, strongly worded rejection of all Roman error, which had been written in James the sixth day, way back in 1581. And everyone in office had been required to sign it in that day. That was called the negative confession. That now becomes part of the covenant of 1638, the national covenant. And please make sure you underline the word national, because I'm going to be comparing it with another one in a few minutes. Second in that covenant was a list of the acts of the Scottish parliaments which had been passed against Romanism. They're renewing the First Reformation and the accomplishments of it. The third is a statement of their purpose, to recover the purity and the peace of the gospel, religion and righteousness may flourish in a land to the glory of God, the honor of the king, the peace and comfort of us all. These people were not anti-government people. They were not anti-monarchy people. They were very loyal to the king. The covenant was written, and there were so many people they couldn't get into Greyfriars Churchyard. I hope you do see Greyfriars Bobby when you come to Greyfriars Churchyard. Greyfriars Bobby is a little dog. It's a little sheepdog that is a monument up there. And his master went in there, and the little doggy would stay with his master for a long time, and I don't know when that happened. But I would guess that 90% of the people who come to Greyfriars Churchyard see the doggy, but they don't know one thing about the covenant that was signed there. Henderson and Warriston read the covenant, explained it, answered questions. There had been hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people who were there that day. And then they began signing that covenant. This is the congregation from all over Scotland who'd been brought to Edinburgh, called and invited, and they'd come to Edinburgh for the purpose of resisting the influence of the king at that point where he's coming in to control their worship. And some of them even signed in blood because they knew that when the king saw that, he wasn't going to want that. Can we trust each other? Thousands of people here today, but when we go back home, we'll be spread out from Dan to Beersheba, from one end of the land to the other. And then, can we depend on each other when we go back home, when we're all split up and the dragoons can come in and kill us off? Can we keep on depending on each other? That's what the covenant was for. The people who signed that covenant and some of the greatest nobles in all of Scotland had signed. And as soon as it was signed there, then they made copies of that, and that went throughout the whole nation. And that bound the people together in a way they hadn't been bound together before. There had been some covenants before this. It wasn't the first one. But this bound the people together in a very, very, very important factor. In the Second Reformation, in the summarization of the First Reformation, really, as well as the Second Reformation, the nation was bound together in a way they never had been with a unity before. King Charles, when he caught wind of this, took it very seriously. And he said, so long as that document's in effect, he had no authority in Scotland. He didn't like it. But he was obliged to agree to a general assembly to be held in Glasgow that same year, 1638. Guess who they elected moderator? Alexander Henderson. Johnston was the clerk of that first general assembly. The Marquess of Hamilton represented the king's commissioner. And he tried to dissolve the assembly, told them they were acting in rebellion against the king and that they couldn't do it. In fact, he issued an order. After pleading with them the first day, he went out and issued an order ordering everyone who was not a citizen of the city of Glasgow to leave the city immediately. That, would, of course, included all the commissioners, all who were there. But the assembly continued anyway. And it acted to overthrow the entire Anglican or hierarchical form of government, rejected all the recent changes in worship, excommunicated 8 of the bishops, and suspended 6 others. Six or eight. I'm not sure whether my 6 is in the right place there. Excommunicated 6 and deposed 8 or vice versa. Reinstated in their place the Magna Carta of Presbyterianism, that is, the system of general assemblies, synods, presbyteries, and church and kirks with elders and deacons. In effect, they overthrew all the kingcraft work of both James VI and Charles I. And Henderson said, "We have now cast down the walls of Jericho." King Charles tried to crush the Covenanters by military activity, but they raised a funny-looking old banner which had on it the words, "For Christ's crown and covenant." And that's where that began to be seen. And under General Leslie, the Covenanters won the war. Now, this is one of the enigmas, one of the amazing things. They lost more battles than they won. And they were beaten from pillar to post, but they won the war. They won an occasional battle here and there. But when the Revolution Settlement was signed in December of 1689, the things they had been contending for, almost without exception, maybe three exceptions, were granted to them. In 1642, King Charles also found himself at war with his people in England. His policies in England were no more acceptable than his policies in Scotland. In 1642 and 43, the English began asking the Scots people for help. And that would be a real miracle. Only God could have brought the English people to the point of asking the Scots for help. But they asked for help of two or three different kinds. One of the things they said is, we don't know how to govern ourselves down here in England. We've never had any experience in that. But we know that you found some way up there in Scotland of kirks and presbyteries and synods and general assemblies, and you're governing yourselves. Would you come down here and show us how to do that? And then the second thing we need is a little bit of military help. Would you send that General Leslie down with some troops? And we'll set up an assembly down here. And you send some of the men who know about how these things work in the church down with us. And Scott said, yes. One of the first things that we found is that this covenant draws us together and we can depend on each other then. And we really don't know whether you mean business or not down there in England. But what we'll do is draw up another covenant called the Solemn League and Covenant. The Solemn League and Covenant. 1642-43. The Solemn League is not just a covenant. It's not certainly not a national covenant. This is a Solemn League and Covenant. I wish we could talk for another hour about that. I went over a few years ago to the centennial, one of the centennials, the observations of the Westminster Assembly, and maybe we can do some more on that when we come back from Scotland this summer. We're not going to be able to do any next fall. I mean, we're not going to be able to do anything more on it now. But it is a league. It is not just a covenant. It involved not only Scotland and England, but also Ireland, that these people would be drawn together. The army was successful. In 1646, Charles surrendered. But I've always sort of smiled a little bit when I saw where he surrendered and to whom he surrendered. He sure wasn't going to surrender to his own English people down there in England. What he did surrender to was the Scots people up there. And those Scots people have an amazing loyalty in their hearts. And they protected him. They took him in custody. They protected him. They tried to work with him. But they made a big mistake. A year after he surrendered to him, they turned him over to the English. And the English immediately cut his head off. Same thing they did with Mary. Another result of all this unrest was the Westminster Assembly. It began 1643 in July, and it continued to February of 1648. And here was the assignment given to them by the Parliament: for the settling of the government and liturgy of the Church of England, and for vindicating and clearing of the doctrines of the said church from false aspersions and interpretations. A lot of wild rumors going around about what the church really believed or didn't believe. And so that's where the Westminster Confession of Faith came into its own, was really written, and why it was written. Along with it, it provides actually for six documents: the Westminster Confession of Faith, the larger and shorter catechism. Do you know what the catechisms are for? As people would learn the doctrine, then the pastors and elders were to go around into the families and sit down with the people and ask them these questions. And the questions of the longer and the shorter catechisms summarize the entire system of doctrine that is spelled out there in the Westminster Confession of Faith. And for those of you who are interested in an excellent short course in systematic theology, you have no better way of doing it than to memorize those catechism. And you said, Margie, what? How many do the children have? There's some of those children who have.
Thirty.
But you told me just last week that there were, you had listened to how many that evening?
Well, right now, about 14 or 15, we're starting over again. But some of them are.
How many questions, though?
30 or 34.
30 or 34. And what are the ages of those children? 6 through. Six through 13 have already caught 30 or so of those. I don't.
We're up to about 89. Before we started over.
My point in grilling you on this is that I don't think that they could be too much ahead of you folks as far as capacities are concerned.